is Sportsfeld back for another week, and the season's over. Boy, oh boy. Trying to piece this together.
Got like 2 days of distance from it, and was feeling okay, and now I have to die by ignoring baseball entirely. Now I have to dive back in, which I don't want to do.
This is the gig. The gig is to examine, to dissect the frog. I feel a little bit relieved because I got a lot out on Sunday night. I got a lot of my snap reaction emotions out of the way right away, which was mostly positive. I in the heat of the moment after watching four games at once, or three games at once, which I do not recommend over the course of 4 hours, I came away honestly mostly appreciative. And now the day after, Monday, I felt terrible. Monday I felt way worse than I felt Sunday night. And then yesterday, to your end there, I literally tried not to think about it at all on Tuesday. And now it is Wednesday, and we are tasked with talking about it. Of course, the thing we are talking about is your Toronto Blue Jays not making the American League playoffs, finishing with 91 wins, which I think at many stages throughout the year would have been above and beyond expectation. I think, you know, we will get into this, but I think as a general statement, basically to a man, aside from the back half of Hyunjin Ryu's season and the last 4 months of Randall Grichuk, almost to a man, overperforming expectations up and down the lineup, and still finishing a game back of the playoffs. You can wallow, you can pick your game, you can come up with your one thing that makes you upset about the year, but ultimately it all comes down to what I thought was a very entertaining year, was a very fun team that just unfortunately came up an absolute hair short of what we ultimately had as what I would call a stretch goal for the year, right? I think playoffs in our minds, we had talked about 86, 87 wins, 90 plus and a playoff spot was what is called a stretch goal, where you shoot for the moon and try to land among the stars, as the old poster would tell you. Ultimately still a pretty disappointing end to, I think, what was a positive year.
Yeah, I think, you know, 3 days later, I guess we can call it 2 days, whatever, I am starting to be able to look at this rationally. I think I've been working really hard to look at this rationally, I think, because Sunday night I was not in a good mood. I would not have recorded a positive Blue Monday episode on Sunday evening. But here we are now on Wednesday. And, you know, it's still disappointing, I think is the word. And, like, not, I think part of it is, like, you know, I miss having it to watch every day. Because, mm-hmm. like, you know, we mentioned this on our mailbag episode that we recorded yesterday about how like we both watched like 150 plus games this year, and so that's, you know, that's half a year, well, a little less than half a year of like having something to watch and do every day.
Yeah, 150 games at 3 hours a game is 450 hours of baseball minimum. Not counting podcasts, not counting talking about it, not counting tweeting about it, not counting reacting to it. So yeah, it was I think pretty safe to say a 500 hour year of baseball, which that's a lot. That's a lot of attention to give to a team.
Yeah, and I think that so I think that's part of it for me. Also, you know, if we're still in recap mode, I suppose. So the just the way it went down on Sunday was pretty crazy.
Yeah.
It was just like a slow motion.
Crazy.
Like, it was the way it went from 5-1 Nationals to the Rays getting men on second and third multiple times and not being able to cash it in. And then the Red Sox slowly coming back. you could, it was just like watch. I think the fact that like the Jays game was over in the first inning, I've yet to figure out if that made the whole thing easier or harder. Cause like if the Jays game had been close, it would have been focusing on three close games at once, which is no fun. Mm. Like watching the three games at once at all was, I hated it. I'm going to be honest. I did not enjoy it. But the fact that the Jays game almost didn't matter in a sense, cause it was just kind of like over very quickly, allowed for that slow death, I guess, of the season to just happen. And like, you could, yeah, and you could feel it coming, but it was just like watching. And then, as you pointed out, literally the second Sportsnet switched over to Boston, Devers hit the home run. And it was just like, oh, well, there's that.
They left it. It managed to be the longest possible amount of time that the result could be unknown, which is not what you want. It would have been easier to stomach if the other games had gone the same way the Jays game went, where it was a 10-run thing, or you know, Tampa waited until the third game of that series to finally lose. It would have been, if they had just lost on Friday, it would have never been anything. But certainly, I'll never cheer for the Washington Nationals again in my life. Terrible.
No, absolutely.
What a terrible
not.
Feeling that it was, cheering for Alcides Escobar. Awful feeling. yeah, it was left until the latest possible moment. It was the most time you could possibly go. Both the Red Sox and the Yankees games unknown into the final pitches of the games. Like the game on the line right down to the final outs in both places. The Yankees, of course, walking it off with an infield single by Aaron Judge, who ruined the year. You're pretty safe to say Aaron Judge ruined the season. yeah, definitely hard to swallow on Sunday night. And like you, my overwhelming feeling on Monday was I just wanted to see more games. I just wanted to spend more time with this team because it was such a fun group and they seemed to really enjoy playing together. And joy that they played with seemed to fuel their performance, right? They seemed to really get energy off of how much fun they were having, and they seemed to have fun because they were playing so well. And those two things really seemed to build on top of each other. And that energy is vitally different, I think, than any version of this team we've ever seen, and really goes hand in hand with how young they were, how exciting the style they played was, how aggressive they were. It was really fun and really exciting, and that much of it is what makes it a little disappointing was, you know, knowing that all of that ends up being again a overperformance of our expectations, and yet also feeling like they underperformed, which is a really interesting sort of dichotomy because, you know, as I said this on Sunday, and I'm going to try not to speak in 4-minute rants every time I talk, but you know, the idea, and a lot of fans had this sort of feeling that the team ended up three or four wins off of what they were supposed to have done. I use supposed to in the biggest shock quotes I can there, in sort of, you know, they should have won four more games. That to me means that you think true talent wise the 2021 Blue Jays were a 95 win team, which to me is tremendously positive, and it's incredible to say that in the minds of those fans, they went from a 95 loss team to a 95 win team in basically a year and a half, because they only played a 60 game year the year before this. That's a really incredible turnaround and a really impressive place for them to get to. And I think if that's the reality and that is true, and true talent wise the core that's in place is a 92-94 win team, it's hard for me to be mad. I'm upset, but it's hard for me to be mad about anything that happened this year.
I agree, actually. And I think that, I mean, let timeline alone, you know, I've seen a lot of, well, this is because they didn't fix the bullpen in the first half, or it's because they played on the road for 2/3 of the season, or, you know, Marcus Semien couldn't throw to first once, or Josh Palacios dove poorly. And I don't think those things are necessarily incorrect. But I do think that it also doesn't matter. Because right. you've pointed this out before, that there are many games you could look to this season that they absolutely shouldn't have won. You know, not even thinking like Boston and Oakland and two in Baltimore and all those games. Thinking back to, I think it was against the Marlins in like April or May or June. There you go. I think it's June 2nd when they came back in Dunedin against the Marlins, which like was a great time. But if you're looking at how those games should go, like they were down, they scored three runs in the bottom of the ninth when they were down 5-3. So there's lots of games that go both ways. And the joy and pain of a 162 game season is that things do kind of even out in mm-hmm. the end. And also, I think it's fair to say the other way. Not so much the, oh, this game, that game. But like, I very much believe if they had been in Toronto the whole time, they'd be in the playoffs right now.
Yeah, there's a couple of great points in there, and I agree with that overarching message of, you know, the next team that goes 162 without a period where their bullpen is bad will be the first. The next team that doesn't have a period where they don't hit with runners in scoring position for some reason right. or the other, that happens to everybody. That's why they play 162, as you said, and you have to ignore the weekends where they completely ruined a team's bullpen for four games, or where they, you know, as you said, made those comebacks. The Semien one, of course, sticks out especially because he was so good all year long. He played all 162 games. He did nothing wrong all year long. Just it was literally two outs in the ninth inning of a game they were winning. I totally get why that one sticks out. Other stuff, you know, over the last couple of days sort of been taking this mental restock, and you can look at there was a whole series against the Yankees where they were in the lead in all three games and lost all three games. There was the series against Boston where, if you remember, they outscored them like 17-5 and split the series. Those are the ones where like those are the teams they directly finished one game behind. That makes it super easy to point out. But yeah, ultimately, listen, it's a 91 win team that
and like I also
is impressive.
I also think to your point there, which is I agree with, the like yes, you can look like their Pythagorean record's 99 wins. So
crazy.
Statistically, yes, they were quite unlucky to be 8 wins less. But I think a thing that people are leaving out when we're talking about the what ifs is the fact that this was a crazy year in the AL East.
For sure. Literally
the first time ever in the three division era, four teams in one division won 90 games. You want to, I'll do it one last time for the 2021 season and compare it to the 2015 team. We talked all year, and we've talked for what feels like 6 years about how crazy the 2015 second half was, which unquestionably it was. 2015, they went 48-23 in the second half. This year they went 46-29.
Wow.
2015, they won 93 games. This year they won 91. And in 2015, they finished in first in the AL East handily. So I feel like there's so, like, you know, not, there's lots to point to as to why they didn't make the playoffs, but I just, when you look at how everything lined up, both things under their control and things absolutely not, I don't see how you can look at the season as anything but a success.
Some more background. The sixth most wins in a season, and again, Pythagorean record isn't real. That's something I need to say.
Yeah.
It's not real.
Yeah.
but Pythagorean record-wise, the fourth best record in team history. So something to keep an eye on there. So it was impressive in that way. And again, individual performances wise, really not much to complain about anywhere. But yeah, as a overarching message on the season, it's almost like perfect to the note of how the year went, because this was what this year was, right? They looked incredible, and then something just didn't quite work. It is sort of funny that this ends up being the year that you know, they win more than they have basically any time other than when they were a World Series team or made the ALCS, right? 87 is the only time. They won 96 games in 87 and didn't make the playoffs because baseball was different in 87, right? You had to win the division to make the playoffs, right? It was East and West. You had to win to get in. But every other time they won, even 89 games, Jake, they made the ALCS. 89, once, in 1983 they didn't, but like 2016 they won 89 games. 89 they won 89 games. 1981 they won 89 games. As you said, 2015 they won 93. 1993 they won 95. 92 they won 96. 87 they won 96. And 85 they won 99. All of those teams at least made the ALCS. So it's they put up, in terms of the franchise history, they had a top six season that they've ever had. A obvious, listen, we weren't watching in 85 and 87. So, you know, in that terms, it's a top five season that we've ever really experienced as fans that were able to, like, be a part of it. That's something that I think as we get distance, we will look back on fondly. But I also don't fault anybody who is, like, still too tender and jaded to not want to talk that way right now.
I also think it's fair to look at everything we just said, and that increases the disappointment.
Sure.
Because, you know, they win one more game. If they get in, like, that this team was extremely good. Like, who knows how far they could have gone? To your point, they won all those games and every time made the ALCS. So, who knows? Which I think does add to it.
Absolutely. And again, I do understand. I do understand how that can be a frustrating thing, especially as the way the season unfolded, the way that you know, fans in this city will take notice when they are on the brink and when they are on the edge, and how bitterly disappointing and unfair it can feel when you're you know, not a hardcore. I don't begrudge anybody for not being a hardcore. We're about to enter a lease season where you and I are about to not be hardcores, be the people that people don't like. But you know, they got a lot of people along for the ride, and then it ends up you think, oh man, unfair the way that sort of played out. And I would say to those folks, unfortunately, baseball is supposed to feel unfair. That's the best way, yeah, I can put it. The baseball playoffs are supposed to be, you're supposed to leave it feeling like that was unfair. That's sort of the way that baseball playoffs always has been and always will be, unfortunately, for worse or worse. The hard part, and Marco Simeon actually mentioned this in his year exit interview, is it felt like they had become the best team in baseball. And maybe that's not totally accurate with the Dodgers and how good the Giants have been, but it was certainly hard to not feel that way in September when they made all that ground up. It's like they've figured it out. They've put the pitching staff together. They have just enough relievers that it's not a problem. And when Springer is here and healthy, and when Gurriel is playing as well as he is, it certainly felt like the best team in baseball. It certainly was the most home runs we've ever seen for this franchise. It was a top six most runs we've seen a team score behind 93, 2000, 99, 2015, and 2013. But a lot of those teams are evidence that runs isn't everything. I think what makes it hard and what makes it challenging, and you sort of touched on this, is what makes it so disappointing is there's, other than, oh, there was a period where the bullpen was bad, there's not a lot, like, the pitching staff wasn't bad. Like, they have four really good starters. Yeah. The offense was otherworldly. That's what makes it so difficult, is it's hard to look at it and be like, oh, there's this obvious hole. It's like, oh, Kirby Yates not being totally sunk money out of the gate would have been nice. Or, you know, somebody other than Tanner Roark. If we had known Manoah was going to be ready right away, or if Pearson had worked out. Like, there's a million of these little one things, right? If they had one more reliever, if they had one more starter from the jump, maybe we're talking about a different situation. But again, that also brings me back to, like, they're going to start next year, and it's not going to be like, let's see what we can do. The MO for next year is we are competing this year. And the progression of a rebuild is at the point now where it's all in time. And they've done a good job in the last two off seasons of supplementing their young core. And now we know what they have in Vladdy. We know what they have in Bo. We know what they have in Teoscar. We know what they have in Springer. We know what they have in Manoah. They're in a spot where the finding out is sort of finished, and now, you know, adding those final pieces that we talked about at the beginning of the year, right? We talked about how the pieces they were missing were the easy pieces to address. An extra bullpen guy, one more infielder, a bench bat. Like, that's the stuff that is really exciting, is they can go out and address that without it being like, you know, where are they going to get an ace? Where are they going to get a starting center fielder? Like, that's what is really nice to know.
Yeah, I think I'm far and away from, you know, and despite myself, I would say, far and away from, you know, you and I talked this on Sunday, where I was kind of saying, well, now there's no excuses for
sure
the front office. And you pointed out correctly that, like, well, in the last couple of years, they haven't really steered wrong. And, you know, I can argue that about bullpen readiness this year, but I could also argue that I don't think anybody, including them, expected to have a team that would be, you know, 91 wins when we're thinking, wow, why didn't we fix the bullpen earlier?
Right.
And I think that you can fairly argue that going into the season with the bullpen they had was a mistake. And I mm-hmm. would argue that. Or at least not, if not the bullpen they had, at least with, like, relying on guys like with huge injury history like Yates or Merriweather, and or guys like Dolis or Chapman, where it's like, well, we'll see. And
right.
not having a backup to that. I think that's a very fair criticism.
Sure.
However, now that they have proven themselves to be a 91-win team, as they prove throughout the season, you can find those guys.
Absolutely.
Relatively simply. Like, yeah. Simber especially, were unbelievable this year. And they got them for pennies. And, you know, I know there was talk today about what Nate Pearson's future holds. It wouldn't shock me at all to see him in the pen next year. And if what he shows at the very, very end of this season is anything to go on, that could be a great piece. Merriweather gets a whole year to rehab, and I don't mind banking on a guy with his injury history when you have the other pieces there already.
Right.
So I think that there's good claim to think that the roster will be much stronger on day one. And I would also say that now that we know what the team is, if it's not where it needs to be on day one, then there's a problem.
We're going to save some of the really deep dive, off-season stuff for when we get a little further into the playoffs. I think right now it serves us best to look a little bit more back than it does look a little bit more forward. But before, as a general statement, what I would say about this, and I think maybe it was Nick Ashburn who made this point on Blue Jays Happy Hour, is, you know, you can see concern, for example, from fans who look at this and they say, well, Vlad was basically the MVP, right? If Shohei Ohtani doesn't do something no one's ever done, Vlad's the MVP. And,
right.
And Semien was a 45 home run second baseman. And Bichette, you know, hit 300 and hit basically 30 home runs and stole 25 bases. And Espinal ended up hitting 311. And on and on and on. You know, Teoscar drove in 116. And they got up and down the lineup, they got great contributions. And Ray was basically a Cy Young guy. And Matt's had a career year. And on and on and on. And you say, I'm a little bit worried, right? Because all of that feels wasted. And what I would say to that notion is both the teams that got in ahead of them and the fact that they were this talented and didn't get in is sort of an idea of, like, just because maybe next year they don't have the individual success doesn't mean they won't be a more successful team. You know what I mean?
It's, yeah.
Like they can deal with, you know, next year Vlad is an all-star and he's the top three MVP guy, but maybe he doesn't hit 50 and you know, his OPS isn't 1,000 and he, you know, it's just 9-something, or you know, the guy they get to replace Semien, whoever it may be, doesn't hit 45 and isn't, you know, a gold glover and whatever your step back is, they can be a little less top end talent and still be a more successful team, because first of all, they had talent to spare, and second of all, you know, it the things that plagued them, as you mentioned, the bullpen, depth, like bat depth. How, you know, in the beginning to mid part of this season, we were like, man, they can't pinch hit anybody because the pinch hitter is McGuire, or the pinch hitter is Jonathan Davis, or the pinch hitter is, take your pick, right? Riley Adams, like Joe Panic. I mean,
you can make that argument even deep into the year. Carrying the three catchers was insane.
Totally, totally. So if you're able to do those things, you know, you can weather the fact that maybe Espinal isn't a guy that you're going to play 90 games next year and he's going to have a 114 OPS plus. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
There's a chance that comes back down to earth. You can weather that stuff if you address the small things. And we talked about this, again, this is something we talked about a couple times during the season, but this is what the step to being a contender is. It is, okay, we've got the core is solid. We know who the shortstop is. We know who the first baseman is. We know who's hitting cleanup. We know who's playing center field. We know who the ace is. We know who the number two is. We know who the number three is. What we need is first guy out of the bullpen that stops the jam. What we need is shut down lefty. What we need is matchup bat off the bench. I think Corey Dickerson might come back. But that sort of thing is like, you know, how do we make ourselves, and I think the perfect example of to how I would look to build this team, and a bit, and I think probably how they have looked, is how the Houston Astros sort of built this thing, where it was like, okay, they had put together the core with Springer and Correa, and they sort of put it together. They tanked a little bit, but once they put it together, they are like, okay, we need to go out. And, you know, the rotation in 2016 was Colin McHugh, Doug Fister, Mike Fiers, Dallas Keuchel, and Lance McCullers Jr. And they won 84 games. And the next year they came back and they said, you know, we're going all in. We're making it like for real. And they bolstered it with veterans, you know, Yuli Gurriel, Brian McCann, Josh Reddick, Carlos Beltran. Like, they went and they made sure that every single day, and this is what the Rays are so good at, they made sure that every single day they could match up with who they were playing against. That, you know, they got Marwin Gonzalez and Evan Gaddis and Jake Mariznick and these guys that they could put in any situation, and they doubled down on that, right? And they went forward the next year and got 103 wins because they had Verlander and Cole, and then they went out and they got, I think they went out in the next year and they got Zach Greinke. Like, this is sort of how you do this is you Wade, my, like, it's crazy. This is, I think, the example to follow, right? Is you make sure that you go from, like, you know, they add Michael Brantley. It's crazy, but you go from, like, you know, we are in good shape and we are a good team to we can match up with anybody no matter what they throw at us. And that, I think, is this next level for them. And you know, there's been a lot of talk about the diversity and approach they need to have in that, you know, they're sort of an aggressive team. They attack early in the count, and good teams, you know, would be able to find a way to silence that. If they're able to find some guys that can disrupt that you can throw in and say, okay, instead of Randall Grichuk, you know, and this is almost makes me mad, Jake, to think about this. But like, if this year, I remember going to bed thinking they had Michael Brantley, right?
Yeah, I was going to bring this up, but I didn't.
If they have Michael Brantley instead of Randall Grichuk, you're like, okay, it's not the same guy in 1 through 9, right? There's going to be guys that are going to change your approach and guys that make sure you can adapt. And I think there's two big things that I think is important coming forward. And I think one of them, as I said, is finding those pieces in the offense so that you are matchup proof, so that when the Rays are like, okay, we're going to do an opener, so that we start with the righty and we move to a lefty, or vice versa, you say, that's fine. We have any style you want to play. You want to play dink and dunk, you want to play long ball, we can do that. And making sure that you have the line of pitchers, as you mentioned, relievers that you can bring in to face anybody, starters that, you know, they got a great thing out of Alek Manoah this year. They got 20 great starts out of Alek Manoah. How can you supplement that? Who can be that next piece of that thing? And developing pitching is such an important part of being a sustained winner, that the Dodgers have been incredible with that. Like, think about the fact that the Dodgers were able to be like, okay, we don't need to bring back Hyunjin Ryu because we have guys crawling out of the woodwork Walker Buehler suddenly is here, Julio Urias is here. And then they supplement that with your shithead Bauer, and they go and trade for Scherzer. Like you're able to do that if you're able to develop and put together important pieces in your rotation and in your bullpen, as the Rays do and as the Dodgers do. It makes getting those big pieces all the more effective, and I think that's the road for this team. And I'm, as you said, I have no reason to not feel optimistic that obviously the guys building this team know this, and that they're able to identify the guys that can fit into this, because boy, do they ever hit home runs on Semien and Ray.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, as you said, we'll get into this more later in the offseason, but obviously the big questions right now are Semien and Ray. But the question is, do they have to be?
Right.
Like, I think that they're in, I think they're in a good spot. I think that the emergence of guys, obviously the emergence of guys like Manoah, is huge. Even maybe Santiago Espinal is like, could be a real piece. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not setting the world, he's not making an all-star team, but you need those guys. Again, you think back to 2015 and when Devin Travis went down, we had 150 games of Ryan Goins. And like having a guy like Espinal who is categorically not Ryan Goins is a good thing. Who knows? Genuinely, who knows what Kevin Biggio is? Like, I think there's interesting. I think they're in a good spot, and I think that, you know, I think I said this a couple weeks ago to liken it to the Maple Leafs, where the first Matthews year they lost to Washington, and it felt like it was the beginning. I think this does too, and I didn't on Sunday. On Sunday it was hard to see that, but then today, just today, I was thinking that like, Vlad's here for like five more years because of baseball's horrible contract system. Like, there's so much time to build and be good, and there's a chance that they're good for a while.
Absolutely.
So, I don't know. It's not all bad. I do wish they were playing tomorrow, though.
Yeah, absolutely. Ultimately, the feeling was I wish they could play more games. But yeah, I think we're both. You know, I think this is a good. It's good that we're recording on Wednesday and not Monday, because Monday I was just angry and sad, and it certainly didn't help last night when I was like, "Oh, they almost certainly would have been better than the Yankees in the wild card game. Like, they certainly wouldn't have lost 6-2. That seems right. Pretty unlikely. Yeah. That they would have gotten dog walked like that." Yeah, very very interesting. I think some well earned faith, and I would, you know, as I said, we're gonna wait a little bit. We'll let some offseason stuff sort of build and deal with that when we get a little closer to it. But I would also caution, if you're a fan that did get caught up in that and you are looking for like a next step, if Ray or Semien don't come back, like, don't immediately declare it a failure of because there's a lot of, you know, Semien was an incredible thing to identify and pick, pluck out, and Ray has been an incredible reclamation project, and they have found some great things in there. But, you know, first of all, there's a lot of shortstops in the market this year. They may think that they can identify a way to replace those guys' production in a way that I think they've sort of earned at this point a look about that it may be possible. Who in the world thought Marcus Semien was going to hit 45 home runs this year? Like, that's,
I think it's fair to say literally nobody.
That's absurd. Like, his previous career high was 33, and that was a damn good year. Like, he was an MVP candidate that year. So I just think, you know, obviously Ray had a great year. I've also sort of cooled a little bit. I'm like, I don't know if I am rushing out to give Robbie Ray, 5 years, 125. I have no idea what he's going to command, but like, you know, are you paying Robbie Ray at the expense of, like, after next year Jose Berríos isn't coming back, who's 27 years old and also pitched very very well? There's a lot, these are big questions to be asked here. It's not really as simple as like, back the truck up for Ray and Semien and you're set. Like, as easy and as fun as that is to do, and if that is the way you feel, I don't hold it against anybody, but like, it really isn't that easy that you're able to be like, okay, pay those guys and everything's set. I still would like one of them back. I would. The more I think about it, the more I would love it to be Semien, and for him to, like, you know, look at this shortstop class and be like, you know what? I think if the money's similar, I think I want to stay in Toronto and see this through with this incredible core. But you're also talking about guys in their 30s. But again, I'm going in circles here. Semyon certainly seems like the kind of guy that you invest in, because boy, was he an important piece around all these youngsters.
Yeah, like you could even tell in Bo's sort of post-gamer how important and influential he was on his year. And, you know, I think with as great as Bo and Vlad are, they are still 22 and 23 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Need those. You still need the guy. Like, no, it's when Springer was playing hurt, he said he can't show it because that's not what the clubhouse leader does. And, you know, I think I'm not going to argue the truth or not of that statement, but you need those guys on these teams. And I think obviously Vlad and Bo will become those guys and may already be those guys. But the more guys like Semyon you can have to take guys like Bo under their wing, or, you know, Ryu to Manoa or whomever, the better.
Absolutely. It's going to be an interesting offseason. I will, again, we're going to have a whole breakdown of targets, and I think it's going to be a lot of fun because we know easy to identify what you're looking for and what it's going to be. And we'll just close by saying a catcher of your choice and an infield prospect of your choice for Jose Ramirez.
Yeah.
Sign the check. Sign the check. Problem solved. Espinal and Biggio are second. Replacement found. Life is good.
Yeah, I would. I won't pay as much money as Rogers would have to pay him, but I would pay a lot of money for Jose Ramirez to be the Blue Jays starting third baseman next year.
29-year-old Jose Ramirez.
That would be pretty nice.
3-time All-Star. 3 Silver Sluggers.
Do it.
Absolutely do it. Do it. And then maybe a pitcher. I don't even know who. We're not going to get anybody, but again, you got to
be here. We could be here all day.
We will be here later in the month. But absolutely, as we said, I'll close it up by saying just an incredible base to build this from. And I think ultimately a really positive year. And mostly just sad that we don't get to watch it anymore, because it was a good time.
Yeah, it was really fun. It was, you know what? It was, I would say it was differently fun than 2015 and 2016. Some of that is pandemic related.
Sure.
But it was a very fun year.
Yeah. And I will say something that I think I realized as I was doing the Sunday show was, I don't know that I realized until Monday how much I appreciated just having it back every night was, because the 2020 season was so quick and such a flash that you sort of didn't get the, like, you know, every single day for 6 months. It was awesome. And we both have sat through 6 months of pretty lifeless, pretty not fun teams. This was an incredible breath of fresh air and an incredible team to follow. And it was certainly fun way more often than it was not.
Yes, I think that's a great way to phrase it.
Anyway, that about does it. I'm about emotionally drained and about sick of talking about sports for a minute. We're going to get into your songs and matches and TV shows of the week. I think I know what the TV show might be, but we will see. Maybe. We'll talk about it on the other side after this. We return with take your mind off baseball with something else, and it certainly isn't going to be other baseball. I'll tell you that much. Certainly not. Certainly not.
No. Very little chance I watch any of the playoffs.
No, I just wanted to see what the result of that last night's game was. Actually, sitting down and watching all 4 hours of it.
I didn't even know the final score today. They told me.
Kudos to those who, and I saw you out there. Those of you who watched all 9 innings and like. Tweeted 8 times, the Jays would be better in this spot. Don't need to do that to yourself.
Here's something I will say, though. I'm not going to watch it, but I would love the Dodgers to lose tonight.
Sure.
That'd be hilarious.
If you did have to pick, who do you want to win the World Series?
Oh, Milwaukee. Milwaukee's the only team that doesn't care. Like, the only redeemable pick this year is Milwaukee.
Who do you want to come out of the American League?
It's the Rays, isn't it? None of them. It is the Rays. The thing is, you can't, it can't be the white. I like a lot of the White Sox players, but Tony La Russa, I can't do it.
Yeah.
Houston is Houston, and Boston is Boston.
Yeah. The ship's so already sailed on it. On the, it's like, well, Rays, you've already done all the bad things you're going to do to baseball. You've already done it all.
Exactly. And in the National League, Atlanta's Atlanta. The Dodgers can go to hell. The Giants can go to hell. The Cardinals can go to hell, except tonight. It's just Milwaukee.
Yeah. Jake, what's your song of the week this week?
My song of the week this week is Joni, LA's number one health goth by Illuminati Hotties. If you don't know Illuminati Hotties, it is the brainchild project of what's the word I'm looking for? The pseudonym? Of Sarah Tudson. She's a great singer-songwriter, rock star, whatever you want to call it. She put out a new album, I think it was last week, called Let Me Do One More. It's great. It's music's great. It's really funny. Really great song titles, such as Threatening Each Other, Recapitalism, Cheap Shoes, and Joni, LA's number one health goth. But yeah, check it out. It's really good. It's a favorite of mine for the year so far.
Beautiful. Match of the week. I'm gonna go. I'm gonna talk about heels again. Give me match of the week. I can't wait to see what happens in the season finale of heels. I know this should be TV time, but got a triple threat ladder match between Wild Bill Hancock, Ace, and Jack Spade. Another banger episode of heels this week. Totally worth your time. Going down to Florida, Wrestling Dystopia, and talking to man Gully, who you pointed out, Michael O'Malley. I guess no, you talked about the other guy, who plays Wild Bill.
Oh, but, that, I mean, I love Michael O'Malley as well.
Yeah, Michael O'Malley, who, get this, Jake, is the showrunner for the show.
Really?
He's the showrunner, and he's the main booker of the Rival Federation, and he is unbelievable in the role. So, Michael O'Malley,
That's awesome.
It's basically him and Stephen Amell's love letter to wrestling. He's so good as Gully.
Michael O'Malley's like a... I feel like he's a Richard Kind type in that he's been around forever and is always great and always popping up in good stuff. I love Michael O'Malley.
Yeah, now he was the host of Nickelodeon's Guts. You know that?
I learned that very recently, and that blew my mind.
I was looking him up, and I was like, man, fucking Gully's the man. And then I was like, wait a minute, he's the fucking showrunner?
I was reading, I think The Ringer did an oral history of Guts about a month ago.
Oh, there you go.
And as I was reading it, it said Mike O'Malley, and I was like, that must just be like another guy from Boston. And then turns out, the same... Michael O'Malley.
He's awesome, crazy. Man. He's so good. Michael O'Malley. Totally, totally, totally good. Jake, it is time for TV time. What are you watching? And we're going to talk about Squid Game? I think it feels like
that. I think this might be the first time where both the shows that you and I have watched this week were the same show.
Yeah.
No one needs to hear our thoughts in the circle. I feel like Squid Game's the way to go.
Yeah, we did Circle last week.
Oh, did we? Oh, okay.
And I ended up saying something that ended up being pretty salient. I said
that's right.
The
guy, you did.
Yes, the best, that's true. Maybe the best player I've ever seen, and he ended up being pretty important.
That's very true. But yeah, the Squids. We watched the Squids. It's an intense show.
Boy, if you were not emotionally and physically drained from the baseball season, immediately watching Squid Game afterwards. Was a choice.
Six of Squid Game might be one of the most intense hours of television I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. It's a Korean drama on Netflix. It is the number one show in 90 countries. It's set to basically crash every record that Netflix has ever had, according to their own PR, which trust it at your own peril, but it's everywhere. I've been telling everybody about it. Really good, super super violent, but in a way that I don't know, it didn't turn me off at any point because of how violent it was. But boy, what a television show!
A thing I liked about it, or at least I guess I should say, found impressive about it, was that I would say about 75% of it is entirely predictable, yet that never once bothered me or got in the way of my enjoyment of it.
Sure.
Which for a show that's like built on plot like it is, I found pretty surprising.
Yeah.
Just like a well-crafted, just a well-acted, well-crafted show.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Yeah, what can even be said? I don't want to spoil it, but holy geez, gripping, you know, devastating emotionally at times, a strong message behind it. We love our anti-capitalist South Korean television and movies.
Truly do. Really do.
Yeah, I thought it was beautiful and happy to have watched it and could not have gotten through it faster. And the idea that subtitles or dubbing, however you chose to watch it, would hold you back from seeing this show, I think is a grave mistake. I think you owe it to yourself if you're looking for a great watch. It's a good game. Give yourself a weekend and destroy yourself emotionally with Squid Game.
Just make sure you don't do what I did. Do not watch episode 6 right before going to bed.
Yeah, that'll bum you out.
Well, we didn't know it was coming, but it was just,
of course.
Woo! That was a mistake. Yeah.
Tough times. So yeah, Squid Game, a hearty endorsement from both of us. But listen, I feel like everybody who has a podcast is going to endorse Squid Game for you this week.
I think so. Yeah, I think that's a fair point.
I also watched the Maple Leafs All or Nothing. We'll talk about that a different day.
I couldn't pay me to watch All or Nothing.
Really not painful. Like it wasn't painful at all.
I just don't mean, it just doesn't interest me.
You don't want to see like behind the scenes? You don't want to see like...
No, because the Spurs one kind of turned me off of it.
Hmm.
Because that just turned out to be like Jose Mourinho propaganda.
Yeah, I would say it's not really propaganda on like... Yeah. I find it interesting to see, you know, to hear the speeches and to hear Joe Thornton talk shit and Kyle Dubas seems like a really interesting sort of type of general manager. It's very good cop, bad cop, Dubas and Keefe.
Hmm.
Okay. I think the idea of who I thought Sheldon Keefe was versus who Sheldon Keefe actually appears to be was just extremely not even close.
Interesting.
I think I had this idea that like Keefe was like a softer, like analytics guy who was like, you know, here to nurture the young guys. And that is just not the case. He's here to tell you that you're playing like horse shit. That's what he's here to do. And swear a lot. I loved it. But yeah, it wasn't particularly like gripping. It didn't go very deep. It wasn't like a very deep sort of thing. It was mostly like if you like to see hockey players swearing and grab an ass backstage, it's pretty much it. It is interesting that Sheldon Keefe, basically from day one at practice and through them being a really good team, is like, we're not going to win in the playoffs. Like he's very clearly like, we're not, this isn't going to work. That I thought was interesting. He seemed to know the whole time that they weren't going to, that it wasn't the right way to be playing, even though they were winning, which I think, you know, there's conversations they have you had at a later date as to the nature of that. But yeah, if you're a Leafs fan, I don't know. I like Jack Campbell a lot more than I did before.
That's what I've seen seems to be the prominent takeaway.
It seems like impossible for a hockey player to be that nice and sweet, but he is. Speaking of television and shows that blow you away, Leaf for 1984, is there a particular scene from a movie or a TV show that just blows you away every time you think about it or rewatch it?
I don't know how to do this without doing spoilers, but sure. I'm not, you know, I still go back and forth on whether or not this is a good movie, because I still don't really know, which I also think is kind of part of its appeal. But there are the last 10 minutes, and there's a specific death in The Departed.
I don't think you need to spoiler alert Departed. That's 15 years old.
I don't
old.
Know. Some people haven't, Cass hasn't seen it. Some people haven't seen it.
Is it the elevator death?
That's one of them. And also the building. The one who gets thrown off the building.
Mm.
That was one of the most amazing like movie theater experiences I've ever had. The like collective gasp in the room when that happened was amazing. I think about that all the time.
I'm going to rewatch that soon. Maybe tonight. No, not tonight. Maybe
it's been a while for me too. I'm due for a rewatch as well. I don't think I've watched it in like 8 years. Every time I'm new, I'm like, man, that movie is great, but I still don't know if it is.
I don't have anything that comes to mind off the top of my head. You know, I think of the bank vault scene in Fast and Furious franchise. That to me, the first time I saw that, I was like, oh man, this changes the game.
Wrench fight in Furious 7 as well.
Yeah, I was very much like, oh, this is we've changed what this series is in a very good way. In that scene, I think Gina Carano turns. She does like a switch that I remember the audience audibly gasped in the theater I was in, and I was like, that's cool. I don't know why my only thought is Fast and Furious, but I don't know if I have a lot of things impacted on my memory like that.
If you go see a Mission Impossible movie in the first week, any reactions, just like the batshit stuff that Tom Cruise does is always fun.
Yeah. Garrett Swan, how would you explain sports sadness to a non-sports friend? Oh, that's a good question.
It's hard because it's like objectively you're sad about something that doesn't matter.
Right, but people get sad about television shows and music.
Yeah,
and
I guess it's similar. I guess it's similar to like being sad about a television show, but like deeper.
Yeah, I would say if, as we calculated earlier, if you say you watched 450 episodes of a show this year, and then you know your favorite character dies in the end, and you like, part of you is like, well, you know, I still went. The show was still great, but I'm really sad that I'm not going to get to see that character do new stuff. That's about as close as you can get it. It's like a justified or an unjustified death of a character you love in a show that you really like and know you would continue watching anyway.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to phrase it.
Boy, Skelly, this is a... Come on. Skelly, why? Remember the game in Washington where the Jays fell behind early, came back to take the lead in the bottom of the seventh, and Brad Hand immediately gave up four runs in the bottom of the inning, and the Jays lost. Anyway, what moment from the season most makes your blood boil?
I don't know if blood boil is the right word, but there's two I keep coming back to in my head. Mm-hmm. And they're both very recent because of what we talked about in the first segment. I mean, trying very hard to not think about early season stuff, or even stuff as close as Semien not being able to throw to first. It's not even really like a bad moment. It was a good moment. But I cannot stop thinking about Thursday night's game against the Yankees. You and I were there in the outfield. We had probably as good a view of this as you could get in the building. I cannot... If that Vlad double that went literally off the very top of the wall clears the wall and it's 3-1 instead of 2-1, I think they win that game. And I cannot stop thinking about that.
Yeah.
Also, the entirety of the Nationals Red Sox series from this weekend drives me absolutely insane.
Yeah. Two good picks. Another one that for me that is also very recent. Grichuk stepping on Gurriel's hand in the middle of Gurriel having literally the best September in team history, and that September getting them all the way back to a tie for a playoff spot, and then for him to be the guy who gets stepped on and for Grichuk to be the guy who does the stepping, a guy whose stock could not have possibly been lower, a guy who was getting pinch hit for by Breivik Valera in big spots down the stretch. It was just like, how is that? How is that the combination of actions? And the angriest I was during the season, and this is sort of silly, but I remember Manoa getting tossed, and remember Charlie not being upset about it, and me just like not being able to reconcile that. Even though, again, I think they came back and won that game. I was like blind with rage. You remember me? I was like, I don't like to be this guy, but I am blind with rage that Charlie just let him wear that and didn't do anything about it. Like, absolutely insane. That drove me, I was just like foaming at the mouth, angry at that.
I mean, like, look, I could easily go through and pick a top 10 of this that's just related to Charlie.
Sure.
Like, easily. I had another one when I saw this question. I was like, oh, that really bothers me too. And it was something also recent and similar to the Vlad thing. And I can't remember what it was.
I was going to say, was it when Chatwood had already been cooked twice and they went to him again?
That one sucked. But again, that's too early for me to be mad about anymore. But yes, that was inferior. I mean, also just like Randall Grichuk playing like 8 games in the last 10.
Yeah.
That was really, he's just a fucking black hole. Jesus.
He ended up playing.
I remember it.
149 games.
Kind of similar. That sucks. Oh yeah. Also, every Trent Thornton appearance is my answer. doesn't matter the context. I thought about this too. Again, this is a big who knows, but the 3 calls that Ron Culpa made in the first Tampa game 2 weeks ago when they were coming back in the bottom of the 9th, and then he just like fucked them on strike calls, which usually is a thing that doesn't like, usually I'm like, whatever, those go both ways all the time, but they were like egregiously bad and the team could have come back in that game and then who knows where we're at. But yeah, I think that one bothers me too.
Paul Adam, what's the worst you've ever been ripped off?
I don't know if I've really been ripped off that much.
I have a low stakes funny one and a high stakes.
I have one, I have a high stakes one that I'm not going to talk about.
Low stakes funny one. I once drunkenly bought a DVD of the movie Sideways at a gas station, and I got home and the DVD case was empty. And I was like, I'm too embarrassed. What am I going to do? Right? Go back the next morning and be like, hey, I bought Sideways here last night. And there's no DVD. I was like, I'm just going to eat that money. That's a complete and utter loss. And this one, I'm over it now, obviously, because it's been a long time. My college girlfriend and I, After college, we moved in together, York Mills and Don Mills or something. And we wanted to get a better place because we hated each other. And she was looking at Tip Top Lofts or something. You know where that is?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which is like a nice, it's a nice apartment complex. And she wanted to view them, and she got caught in one of those scams where it's like it's not a real listing, and the landlord's like, just send me, if you send me some money, if you wire me some money, I can like get you into it. Like, the landlord was like not in the country at the time and was like, if you want to view the apartment, if you wire me this money, I can get you to a lockbox. Like, it was like basically like putting a deposit down just to look at it. And I was so against this idea. I was like, this is the, like, I was like, we can't, it's like, it's such a obvious scam. Like, there's no way we can do this. I was like, I'm absolutely not doing this. And she did it anyway without telling me. And then was like, hey, I lost like $1,000 just wiring it to a random person. Oh my God. She ended up calling, we were in the newspaper for this. She ended up complaining to a journalist or something, and we ended up being in the newspaper for it. I was so mad. Oh my God. But it was a pretty big ripoff. I was like, yeah, that's a pretty big ripoff. We had to go to like a Western Union and wire this person money. Oh my God. Oh my God. And now an alert to not do that very thing comes up. If you back in the day, if you looked at places on Craigslist, oh my God, it was annoying. Holy shit. I was so mad at her.
So that's fantastic.
What a stupid thing to do. Jesus Christ. Anyway, that's the worst I've ever been ripped off. Holy cow. I have like PTSD from going to see apartments for that. That's why I ended up, of the 3 times I moved, I think I took the first apartment I saw twice. I was like, yeah, this is good. It's free to view it. Give me it. Cassie with a great question. What's your least favorite thing about working from home? And what's your favorite thing?
Least favorite thing is just like you get into the doldrums so easy.
Sure.
Like every day I'm just like, oh, it's the same thing I did yesterday. That's fun. I feel like I'm getting out of it now, but I found that the combination of lockdown and working from home and having a really like mindless job, Like, it took me a while to get back to, like, the Jays actually helped us a lot. It took me a while getting back to, like, being social. Because it was just such, like, a constant, like, blah feeling of sameness. Is what I will say. And my favorite thing, because Blake called us out in the replies. I'm trying to not make this a wife guy answer. I guess just convenient. I mean, I don't know. I always work from home. I don't have like a huge comparison. I guess not having to make small talk with people I don't know or like.
See, this is so funny is I was in my office for the first time today with a group of my coworkers in my department. And the number one thing that I miss about working in office is like talking to folks that I don't directly work with or like just people that I don't need things from because I'm a social person and wherever I've worked, I've always been the type to like when I have time or when I need to stretch, like I get up from my desk in my area and go see people and just like walk around and say hello to folks on the departments who I may have bumped into. And meeting people by accident is like a thing that just doesn't really happen when you're working from home and when everything is a Slack message, because you're not going to just Slack a random person and be like, hey, what's up? Or, you know, what did you do? What is, you know, you don't have those random conversations. That I think if you're at an office every day are annoying, but I think when you aren't, you don't, when your work is literally 100% all we ever do is talk about work, you sort of miss that camaraderie of just getting to know people. I really enjoy getting to know people and you know, getting energy from people's personalities and that sort of thing. So I honestly, the small talk and the not only talking to people when somebody needs things, I think is important. And my favorite thing, of course, is being around my wife and dog. it's great. Like, no commute, roll out of bed 5 minutes before I have to go to work. We get to have lunch together. I get, you know, the dog barks at me whenever I need him to. I can, if I'm tired, I just go lay in my bed. What a life. that's amazing. That's amazing. I love that. No question.
I mean, no question. Lying in bed is always great.
Yeah. Next question from Shelby. What are your ideal fried chicken sandwich toppings? That's a good one.
Some sort of like dill-esque sauce.
Yeah, we're talking could spicy here, right?
Could be a blue cheese sauce. Yeah, some sort of hot sauce. Or if you want to go further, make it a Nashville hot and like the chicken itself is hot. Need a little like cabbage or slaw of some kind on there. Basically just make PG Clucks.
Yeah, they're pretty simple, right? You want a lettuce base? Give me a pickle with that hot sauce and a dill sauce.
Yeah.
Easy peasy.
Yeah, I agree.
Professional chefs make it that way on purpose.
I think like the fried chicken sandwich is a sandwich that doesn't need to be complicated.
And James, maybe you have an answer to this. I don't think I do because I am not a smart man. When you buy steak, do you have a favorite cut you always go for? Grocery store? And then he follows up, grocery store or butcher shop? I would love to be one of those guys who says things like, I go to the butcher shop, but I have
Same.
This is like whiskey for me. I don't have the like suspenders, mustache sort of like.
I'll go to Sanigan's when we're doing like a charcuterie board, but to buy like actual like meat?
Yeah.
Never. I also don't really have an answer for this.
Yeah. I get all the reasons why this shouldn't be what I say, but like, I'm not making more than one stop when I go out to get food.
Yeah, I agree. I'm also like
I know I'm not supposed to go to the grocery store to get my cuts of meat, but I'm lazy, man. I don't know.
I'm also like not really a steak guy.
Yeah, I don't have steak enough either. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't make it or eat it that often. I won't. I like it when I do, but it's rare for me.
Great. Yeah, steak's good. It's just, yeah, don't have that much of it. Enough for me to have a favorite thing. And again, I go to a nearby grocery store because I am lazy and I want everything at once. I know all the reasons. Again, I know all the reasons why we shouldn't. But alas, I do because that's who I am. Lazy, lazy, lazy. Anyway, that is it. Another week down the old crapperoo. A time for one more thing. That's whether we are sad or not sad for another week after this. okay, we close things out. It is whether we are sad or not sad for another week. It might just be baseball again.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to be anything else at this point.
Can I vote tired? Exhausted is my sad not sad this week. I'm drained. I gotta tell you,
I'm almost sad that is my sad not sad. You know what I mean? Like, I'd like to be like, ah, other things and like life happened. Like, no, I'm still kind of bummed about the Blue Jays.
Yeah. And like I've said this a couple times, I think, but like really burned out on like getting emotionally invested in other sports right now. I am thrilled for the folks that are sort of doing the reverse of what I just did, where they were sort of like jumping on the Blue Jays because it was great vibes and it was exciting and there was the chance of some really high intensity games, but their love is the Raptors. I'm envious of you. It's going to be a lot of fun. Raptors is going to be a casual thing for me for a while here because I am just like, I was so drained by that Sunday and all of September was, every day in September was like absolutely locked in for 3.5 hours. Absolutely like live and die. Every base runner down the stretch felt like torture. I needed some time off. And I know the Raptors season especially is going to be like, it's going to be about growth. It's going to be about vibes. And if they win, it's going to be fun. I'm just not ready to give myself out there yet. And we've said too many strong words about the Maple Leafs for us to be able to be like, I can't wait for opening night.
I won't lie. I don't give a shit. I think the Raptors could pull me in pretty quickly. But they haven't yet. But I could see they're likable enough. That like I watched the highlights of the preseason game the other day and I was like, okay, I'm not there yet, but I think I could get there by opening night.
That's good. I'm still listening to Blake and I'm listening to Will and Alex. So I will get what's going on, but I'm not gonna be the same level as it was a couple times recently. I'm tired. Boy, am I ever tired. It's a lot of hours. As we said, Jake, 500 hours of baseball. That's
true.
That's crazy. When you add in all the Blue Mondays and all the sports fellows and all the everything, 500 hours. That is wild. And I don't regret it. And they didn't even make the playoffs. What a world. That's it for another week. If you want more Sportsfeld, it is available at patreon.com/sportsfeld. We just recorded the mailbag for the month. You also get lookbacks. We are going back in time to famous moments in Toronto sports history and reliving how we felt about them or if we were there at all for them, what we were doing, who we were, what we became and where it went. All that and more, as well as Blue Monday, which is me talking about the Jays for an hour every Monday morning. I'm going to take this week off, obviously, and then try to come back in the next couple weeks, maybe do a more thorough review with the guest, and then look forward to the offseason as well. We're going to do that, obviously, on this show, but look forward in the coming weeks as well. We're going to do a Leafs preview. We're going to do Raptors preview. We're going to get some guests because, obviously, as you and I just said, we're a little emotionally drained, so we're going to get some smart guests to try to pump us up and let us know what to look forward to and why we should care about this year's Raptors and Leafs, and we will do that next week and beyond. In the meantime, we thank you all so much for listening to another episode of Sportsfeld.